Some road trips can be measured not so much in miles as in psychic distance. Novelist Sherman Alexie grew up on the Spokane Indian Reservation in eastern Washington state, but he went to an all-white high school miles away. So for years, he was shuttling back and forth between two very different worlds, and that's really been the story of his life ever since. Now he's come out with a memoir about his family, and especially about the very complicated relationship he had with his mother, who recently died. He told Steve Paulson that his story is haunted by ghosts.
Well, in the studio where I'm recording right now, I'm looking at a sign in the studio, and it says there are ghosts. I mean, it's quite the magical coincidence. Once again, it's the contemporary and it's the ancient. Everywhere I go, I live with ghosts. And whether you think they're spiritual or whether you think they're real, I'm constantly aware of what is missing. You know, when your mother dies, everything becomes theological. I don't know if you knew that, but it does. And a friend of mine who's just as agnostic as I am said, Sherman, you're like Paul on the road to Damascus, except with a lot more F words.
So you grew up on the Spokane Indian Reservation in eastern Washington state, and you had this incredibly rich history there. You also had to deal with a lot of the problems we often hear about regarding reservation life. I mean, extreme poverty, alcoholism, violence. When did you realize that you wanted or maybe needed to get off the reservation?
Well, I sort of knew it from the beginning. I was a very sick kid when I was born. I was hydrocephalic, and I had two brain surgeries by the time I was 2 years old and had epileptic seizures and other minor, moderate, and serious health issues as a result. And like a lot of really sick kids, when you ask them what they want to grow up to be, they'll say pediatrician. They'll say doctor. I think it's a religious move. It's a way of assigning yourself a future, an afterlife from the sick life you have as a kid. And I was no different. But I knew from the first days of schooling that my tribal school at that point was really bad and was not going to give me the kind of education that would get me prepared for college and get me prepared for medicine. So I knew I was going to have to leave eventually. But to get up the courage took many years. And the inciting event was the first day of seventh grade. I opened up my math book and my mom's name was written in it. My mom's maiden name. It was a 30-year-old math book.
Wow.
And at that moment, I knew I was being crushed, not just because I was a Native American, not just because I grew on the reservation, but the fact that I was poor, the fact that I was rural, the fact that I was from a small town in a small place in a small state. So I was trapped by my zip code.
So you went to a public school with white kids not that far away, right?
22 miles away, I started, and the world turned blonde overnight. You know, my joke is that I was the only Indian except for the mascot.
You would expect this to be really hard for you, being the only Indian kid there at that school. But then at least when you got to high school, you were a pretty popular young guy, weren't you?
Well, you know, I came in different, not just looking different with, you know, more melanin and black hair and with my reservation accent, which sounds like this.
which you can put on and off, I take it.
Yeah, like anybody who comes from an accented culture with a different language that influences the way you speak English, yes, I can drop in and out of it, and it's contagious too. So if I'm around other reservation Indians or I call home to my siblings, I'll quickly be talking like this, and my sons who don't have the accent at all because they're urban know who I'm talking to. But it was incredibly difficult, but I was also attractive. I was new. I was book smart. I was a good athlete.
You were a basketball star, right?
I ended up being a basketball star, captain of the basketball team. I ended up being a good debater, which I didn't know I was going to be.
So it sounds like then you were shuttling back and forth between these two different worlds, 22 miles away. I mean, the all-white school, except for you, and the reservation.
And the thing is, what I realized is I was a first-generation immigrant into the United States. So my memoir and some of my other works are actually, in many ways, the work of a first-generation immigrant, even though I'm indigenous. So that it's an oxymoron, I know, the indigenous immigrant, but I've been oxymoronic my whole life with oxy in parentheses.
What would have happened, do you think, if you had stayed at your reservation school?
I imagine I would have become a teacher. You know, I think there's another life where I'm a high school English teacher and basketball coach. So I imagine I'd be at Wellpinit High School having them read books, and then when school was over, I'd be teaching them how to, you know, play the Warriors offense. I'd be hoping I'd find a little Steph Curry among all my little nieces, nephews, and cousins.
Yeah. Well, I want to give a sense of your family, because that's really what your memoir is about, especially your mother. And you write about an epic New Year's Eve party that your parents hosted back in the early 1970s. You were just a little kid at the time. What happened at that party?
Well, like a lot of alcoholic adults who are listening to this, and they'll certainly recognize the fact that I grew up in the party house, one of the party houses on our reservation where people would gather on a regular basis to engage in heavy-duty alcoholic and drugs addiction. Sometimes there was violence, physical, emotional, spiritual, sexual. So what could be a very dangerous place, and it was scary no matter what. And there was a New Year's Eve party in the 70s, early 70s, where it became very dangerous. And in fact, my father ended up knocking himself out playing Nerf basketball, of all things. My mom punched another woman twice in the face. There was violence everywhere. And I hid in my room with my sisters. And eventually, my mother grabbed us about 3 or 4 in the morning and drove us to Chihuahua. And she often did this. Chihuahua was where she was born and spent a significant amount of her childhood, but it was a little white town. Then she took us back there that night, that early morning. And there, after getting a free breakfast from the sympathetic white waitress, my mother promised us, my brother and 2 sisters, that she would never drink again, that she would stop drinking. And, you know, she was a bipolar liar all of her life. She was a manipulative, mean, controlling, unpredictable. But she kept that promise. She never drank again. And that's the reason why we're all still alive, is the strength of her sobriety.
Hmm. Unlike your father, who did keep drinking, drank quite a lot.
My father kept drinking. He died in 2003 of alcohol-related kidney failure. He was only 62 when he died. It's amazing for me to think about that, 12 years older than I am now. Hmm. The astonishing difference between our lives, my father and I. Yeah. And I'm going to have the largest birthday party ever at age 63.
So your mother, I mean, you've already suggested, I mean, she was this really complicated person. I mean, ornery, could be kind of cruel at times. The way you write about this, it was sort of this open question whether she actually loved you. On the other hand, she was the family breadwinner. She was tough. She was the one who held the family together, and she was widely respected, even loved, by other people on the reservation. Am I getting this more or less right?
Yeah, she's a complicated person, you know. And as I've talked about the book and as I've heard people's reactions to my very complicated mother, I realized that I've written one of those biographies that white guys write about famous white guys that you see all the white guys in the airport reading, you know, with some white guy's face on the cover, and it has a name like Jefferson or Hamilton or JFK, you know, or the 99th volume of Lyndon Johnson. Why does Lyndon Johnson deserve 98 volumes? So I realized that I've written that book, that epic book about a complicated human being, a great human being who never had the chance, because of racism, sexism, classism, to achieve her greatness. But that great woman wasn't necessarily a great mother, wasn't even sometimes a good mother, and was often a bad mother.
Well, I mean, just to cite one example that sort of jumps out at you is, you know, that time when you were 10 years old, I guess you and your mom were having this screaming argument, and she threw a Pepsi can at your head and knocked you out.
Yeah, knocked me out. I was hydrocephalic. I'd had 2 brain surgeries. So a brain injury for a hydrocephalic kid, a concussion for a hydrocephalic kid is not the usual course. And when I woke up from getting knocked out, she was just quilting again. I don't know if she'd even move to help me. So I don't, you know, there's not a long history of well-adjusted children coming from great parents. So, you know, you can find these sort of stories in the memoirs and biographies of all sorts of children of powerful, unpredictable parents. And my mother was no different. I think of the books about James Dickey, the amazing poet, and how he didn't throw Pepsi cans, he threw beer cans.
Yeah. So here's my question. How much are you like your mother?
You know, it's funny. Right now, on the social media Indian world, Native Americans are reacting very strongly to this book, positively and negatively. There's online fights between pro-me and anti-me's.
Must be weird for you to read all that.
I don't read it. I just hear about it. I'm not on social media. But it's interesting. So my sister, and my sisters are kind of a Greek chorus in the memoir. I consult them often for fact-checking, for emotional checking, just to hear their side of things. My sister, after apparently reading some of the social media about me in the native world, texted me and said, "So I hear you got some Indians mad at you again. You're just like mom."
So do you take that as a compliment?
I take it as an accurate statement.
You live in Seattle now, right?
Yes. I've lived in Seattle for 22 years. Hmm. I'm very urban.
Do you go back to the Spokane Indian Reservation very often?
Not a whole bunch, not to the res itself, but I see my siblings in Spokane. The res has ghosts for me, and it aggravates all sorts of trauma in me. So I go back to see my father and now my mother's tombstones, their shared gravesite, and hang around with my siblings a bit, but then I get out. I don't stay the night.
Too many bad memories or too painful?
Too many bad memories. I'm guaranteed of nightmares if I stay the night.
I'd love to end with another reading of yours, if you'd be up for that. I was thinking your poem, Tribal Ties.
I'll do that one.
Okay.
Chapter 81, Tribal Ties. Please remember, as you read my brutal poems about rape and murder and assault and dangerous loneliness ripped from the earth like uranium, please remember, as you read these poems about my dead mother and my dead father and all of my childhood pandemonium, please remember, as I weep inside my verse, that nearly every Indian kid I knew had it worse.
Sherman Alexie. His memoir is called You Don't Have to Say You Love Me. He talked with Steve Paulson.